Bill asked a rather pointed question of Mr. Lynn, probing whether he believed the South Vietnamese could hold their own if the United States withdrew in toto. And Mr. Lynn was firm in the opinion that his country could hold its own against North Vietnam. He was full of rather original opinions, such as that President Nixon may give up all effort in South Vietnam, whatever, with the exception of economic aid, and concentrate on the North, bombing the North until it yields up the prisoners. This he sees as the most likely outcome of the present talks by Kissinger in Paris, which he believes will fail. Most everyone here seems to believe that Kissinger was taken in by the North Vietnamese, and that there is an insoluble impasse. The North Vietnamese will not give in on the agreement of October, will not accept any important concessions. And the United States, on the other hand, will not accept the October agreement. I have my doubts about any predictions. History, and above all this war, is too full of twists and turns, entirely unforeseeable, for any predictions to be very important, it seems to me. What is important, I think, is to observe how the Vietnamese, to all appearances, are full of self-confidence and believe they can go ahead on their own without American military, naval, or air help and make a go of it. One discordant note was sounded very discreetly at dinner by Miss Lien when she pointed out that the economic policy of the present government is to tax consumers increasingly and to avoid taxing the well-to-do. But we do that at home, too. And if governments fell or stood on the question of their social justice, then practically no government in the world would stand very long. In the new issue of Time magazine, dated January 15, there's a report by an American reporter who visited Ann Locke. It's interesting that what he saw is so very different from what we saw. No doubt he had no intention of slanting, but if I had written a report, it would have had a very different meaning. From his report, he saw nothing but destruction, and of course there is vast destruction there. But he didn't stress what seemed more important than the destruction to me, and that is the fact that this is the place where Vietnamization began to work. This is the place where the Vietnamese by themselves, the Vietnamese army, held against a very strong attack by the North Vietnamese army, supported by Russian tanks. He mentions only a few Russian tanks rusted and killed there in the town. We saw up to about 30. There's one factual difference. He saw preserved statues of the Blessed Virgin Mary. He says that he was taken there by an American advisor. We were shown around by a Vietnamese captain. And what the Vietnamese captain showed us was two Buddhist temples, one of which had its roof badly damaged, the other not damaged much at all. In both cases, the images of the Buddha untouched, or virtually untouched in one, and completely untouched in the other. The Time Man says that the North Vietnamese army surrounds the city. Well, that's true. But he doesn't mention that there is a wide open perimeter, at least a mile wide, between the city and high ground, which is held by the South Vietnamese. And the North Vietnamese are beyond that. He doesn't mention that the road from Saigon to An Lac was opened by the South Vietnamese army. And they are not trying to hold it today and are not taking very aggressive action against the North Vietnamese elsewhere in that neighborhood for the simple reason that they're using their best troops and are most active in North Vietnam, where they're still suffering from the last stages, or at least the most recent stages, of the offensive that began last March. I don't think the Time Man intended to lie. It's a rather neat example of how different people see different things and come up with different meanings, both of them telling the truth about what they saw. This is Sunday afternoon. Bill left yesterday morning, and I spent the afternoon resting, or that is, reading in the Continental Palace terrace and watching the quite bored Americans, most of them looking overfed. They're the desk men who are left behind, I suppose, now. And the Vietnamese girls making for them. This morning, I went out to see some Buddhist temples. I wanted to see also La Grande Monde, the famous headquarters of the paramilitary, the Xin Bayan gang, whom President Diem put down in about 1955 or 6. But no one out there knows anything, in Cholon that is, knows anything about La Grande Monde. Finally, investigating, we found that the building has been taken over by the police. The temples are not very attractive. They're quite garish. They don't begin to compare in quality with Japanese temples. Colored bathroom tile is the general effect of the, along with raw concrete, is the general impression of the material. The temples actually are on the second floor, usually. At one temple here in Saigon, we saw a Buddhist association civilians having a sort of a Holy Name Society dinner outdoors under the overhangs of the temple. Later this afternoon, I'm going to the press briefing at 4 and see whether this machine of mine will pick up the briefing and the questions. Every night these days, from 11 o'clock on, I've heard it several times at 11, Bill heard it later, we hear bombing in the distance. Heavy crumps coming closer and then farther away again. And we read in the newspaper that certain positions of the North Vietnamese Army are being bombed to prevent them from staging a Tet offensive against Saigon. Also, there is talk in the newspapers about new security measures at MACV out at Tan Son Nhut Airport. Well, we'll see. It all seems very dim as one hears the bombing and reads about it in the newspaper. Not terribly important. The fact that's being neglected, apparently by Kissinger, and all the way down the line to places like Time magazine, and in general in the discussion of the war in the United States, the overarching fact is that the North Vietnamese Army invaded South Vietnam. After all their pretenses earlier, there's no further chance of hiding the fact from the whole world today that in the spring of this past year, the North Vietnamese Army invaded in force. Now it has been stopped on the whole. Well, there's still some fighting around Quang Tri and some minor fighting elsewhere as on the as beyond the perimeter around An Loc. But the meaning of the fact that it's the North Vietnamese Army that has come south, while the South Vietnamese Army has not gone north, this difference is somehow noticed in public discussion of the war. And yet it's the difference that makes the one side the aggressor and the other side the victim. That's what's being, it's going unnoticed today. The world has paid most attention to the United States bombing of the North. And the killing of civilians in that bombing. It doesn't pay attention to the invasion of the South and the civilians who are killed when a town like An Loc is attacked by the North Vietnamese army, an invading army. The Time man in that report I mentioned a while back does give a number of many thousands of civilians at An Loc who were killed. This is about the only notice I've seen. Usually the sheer act of defense of a southern city like Quang Tri or Hue or An Lạc is somehow, and the damage that occurs, the destruction of the town, the killing of civilians, is somehow attributed to the debit side of the South Vietnamese and American ledger. The fact that this damage to human life and to property is really caused in the first place by an invading army attacking. And the corollary that any response by the United States, as in the air bombing of the North, is really strategically a defensive measure. All this is ignored. No such analysis has been made anywhere that I have seen. It would be rudimentary in talking about former wars, as I think of how writers deal with the problems of laying out the facts of the wars. Years after the Second World War, we became rather queasy about the firebombing of Dresden, firebombing of Tokyo, and most of all, the use of the atomic bombs in Japan. But that was long after the war. That was in a situation when we were concentrating on how to prevent future wars and to prevent them from becoming so devastating if they did occur. When it was actually happening and we got full news of the firebombing of Dresden, I remember distinctly reading all about it, and the same about other such episodes, including the dropping of the two atomic bombs. There was no noticeable opposition in the United States, Britain, anywhere on the Allied side. The difference here is that people have turned against the war itself. Our mistakes, our failures, the very length of the war, are such that there is no heart for it any longer. And the strange result is that we transfer these feelings to the tactics and strategy of the war, deciding that there is something immoral about the thing in an absolute sense, when actually far more severe actions were taken in the Second World War. And at the time, because we believed in the war, we found nothing morally objectionable about those actions. So it seems to me that what matters is whether you support the war or not, a particular war, and whether you do or don't. If you want to understand a war properly, you will take into account the vagaries of public opinion, the trotting out of moral views on some occasions, the neglect
of the same moral views on other occasions, according to actually a self-deluding differential code. A deeper matter revolves around the fact that we were fighting rightist governments in the Second World War, and we're fighting self-labeled leftist governments in the Korean War and in this war. I think this is basic in understanding the difference in public opinion. Certainly, the number of civilians who were harmed by the United States in the Second World War was proportionately as great or greater as in this war. Elizabeth tells me that Sulzberger has written in the Times that napalm was first used by the United States in the Korean War. My recollection is that it was first used in Japan. Bill Henderson, however, says that all we used in the firebombing of Tokyo and other cities was phosphorus bombs. Well, that's something to investigate. In either case, the objection to our use of firebombing materials, the creation of great conflagrations that destroyed, tortured and destroyed civilians. In both those wars, the objection was relatively small. And the use of napalm in this war does not really account for the difference in public response. Public response, I'm becoming convinced, is to other things than napalm, defoliants, killing of civilians, creation of refugees, and so forth. I'll shift to a different cassette in recording the press briefing this afternoon. This is Monday evening, January 16. In talking to various people and going about for a week now, I find that there are various themes. For example, there's the theme of satchel bombs thrown by Viet Cong, passing by cafes and other crowded places, passing by on their motorbikes. They, in the past, have thrown satchel bombs. And so people speak of satchel bombs as one of the hazards of life in Saigon. But I noticed in talking this afternoon, for example, to Mrs. Turley, the wife of Professor Turley, who is working on defectors, studying defectors from the North. Mrs. Turley speaks of satchel bombs and other hazards quite casually, as one might about traffic accidents at home. Another theme is apathy. The majority of the people are said to be apathetic about the war, or neutralist, or I suppose the old term was attentiste. And they are said to care very little which side comes out ahead, so long as the war ends. It makes one wonder whether such a sentiment might not have been found quite widespread among people in the North during our Civil War, when the war stretched on for 2 more years after Gettysburg, or in various other wars that lasted too long. For the great majority of people to be politically active and politically committed, I think, is highly exceptional. The American people were active and committed in the Second World War, and our generation takes that as the standard. But I don't think it is normal at all. I think it's probably unusual. Another theme is thievery. A great deal of it is supposed to go on, especially in relation to American material. American material which shows up on the black market and in the thieves' market. Well, I know that in Annapolis, at the PT boat factory during the Second World War, there was an immense lot of thievery of fine sets of tools and such things. How is one to gauge when thievery amounts to a social breakdown and passes beyond the limits that society can tolerate? I doubt that anyone is able to answer that question. Another theme is President Thieu's aloofness. He is said not to know what is going on in Saigon or the country. He is said to hold himself very isolated from the people. Well, of course, we hear the same thing about President Nixon, but we don't draw any pessimistic conclusions about the future of American society because of President Nixon's oddities. Yet, President Thieu's behavior is talked about as if it signified a great deal more than President Nixon's, a great deal more for the success of the South Vietnamese government. Perhaps what distinguishes this war from others, more than any other one thing, is the number of refugees that it has in the word, the horrible word that's used, generated. I know nothing about this as yet. One sees no particular sign of refugees around the city as a whole, but I am going to visit the main refugee center in the Saigon area. Miss Lean tells me she will be able to arrange that. This is Tuesday, January 16. Today I had a long and very interesting interview with Dr. Phan Van Thin, PHAN-VAN-THINH. He has the rank of ambassador and is head of the American section in the Foreign Office. One of the points he made that I thought quite interesting was that Kennedy's policy was a continuation of containment, while in '65, Johnson, in his San Antonio speech, changed that and made a commitment.
Dr. Thin believes, however, that the United States, the great failure of United States policy, was that it couldn't make up, the American leaders couldn't make up their mind whether to go all the way or not to move. And they ended up like a boxer using his figure, a boxer using only one hand with the other tied behind him. When the right thing was done, it was done too late. For example, he said mining the harbors in the north should have been done in 65 instead of just last spring. Heavy bombers should have been used earlier instead of just recently. And so on.